And I think Dr. Chahine said something about maybe the state could help fund this hospital and open it to everyone. I wonder if it's, if there would be any federal law that would prohibit something like that?
Yeah, well...
How about, would it be impossible, for example, for the state to contract with IHS under federal law?
At this point, the only legal opinion I've had personal witness to has been, you know, regarding the inquiry of Lee Wisconsin Hospital. And it was a legal opinion written by a regional lawyer, presumably Attorney General's there. But pretty much gives a total negative. If I could just characterize it, it was, you can't do it for this reason, and that reason, the other reason. No fee for service can be done in a federal facility constructed for the purpose of serving the last community. I'm not that cognizant, I can't recall well enough to give you the legal definitions, but it was clearly a, not under federal law, you can't. I know Senator Stevens is interested in that, and it's the only rational way, it seems to me, to look at Bethel's need for an alternate healthcare system to make use of what we have.
Yeah, that's been, you're correct, Joan. It's been a long series of opinions, because we did experience a period of time in Anchorage when Providence shut down, and you had a community of, you know, 40-some thousand people with no hospital service available, and the opinion came back negative there. But I think you have a Congress now that will address that. Because, you know, somebody wrote those laws to begin with. There's nothing that says somebody can't change them again. And I think it's going to happen, and Stevens is leading the fight on this Bethel law. To be exact, not to get Murkowski and Young doing the same thing or somebody. It's not out of the realm, Charlie. Those things will become, since they're there, available to all citizens rather than segregation.
Well, another alternative, it may sound wild, but you notice, you probably read recently that the state's going to be taking over some BIA schools. BIA got a funding cut, and their response was, well, we've got to close up this many schools and turn them over to the state, right? So those schools will either become part of an REAA, or they'll go into, unless they're going to first-class city schools, but they'll become state responsibility. It might be possible just to have a state, have a federal government turn over all IHS installations in the state to the state of Alaska and just give us money instead of giving it, instead of funding them. Let them just give it to us.
Contract with us for the services.
Well, just give us the hospitals and then instead of appropriating this money through IHS channels, appropriate it, just give it to the state of Alaska and let us run all the hospitals. And I'm sure it may sound like a wild idea, but all we're doing is kicking around different ways to maybe improve what we've got. We know what we've got isn't good enough.
That's pretty wild, right?
Well, it's not beyond the realm of possibility. We're taking over
the
school.
Your tenure,
take over there.
The federal government has already committed to the Native Organizations a sort of option of self-determination that all has to be considered before we're going to stay in the state.
Well, from what we heard earlier, though, the federal government has not committed any level of funding. Now, if it's part of this trust responsibility, it's not committed to any level of funding. So, you know, if the funding level is zero, what difference does it make what kind of commitments they've made, right? If they reduce it this year by 10% and next year by 10% and keep on, what have you got? You know? So
they admit the obligation, but payment is coming. Oh, I know I owe you. You're going to get it someday.
Now, you could take it over and run it like Norton Sound is running the one in Nome, couldn't you? Actually, now it's open to everybody up there.
Right.
And they do get third-party payers.
Ripple Bay Health Corporation is the only corporation that has actually taken over and is running the IHS facility. doing what it's originally intended to do.
As Barry said, the Norton Sound was a private facility. It was not an IHS hospital. The first one that's really been done in the last few years is building it.
No, but the principle is the same. One of the local corporations is running it and running it as a nonprofit corporation, right?
They moved in at a time when our funding levels were far better than they are now, and there weren't developmental monies available, and that, I think, has permitted them a head start on the rest of the corporation. So that's a very viable program that you probably get together. But they also had quite an additional third money to accomplish that.
Joe, didn't they do something similar in McGrath, too? That was a PHS.
I'm not sure I've heard of that.
Seems to me they did.
Is anyone else? Any other topic? There was a study done for the state about 2 years ago on the rural air situation and rural airports, and then I think, if I remember correctly, there was some money appropriated, and I believe somebody is out looking, been looking at them this year to see what's been done to improve it. So it is something we're aware of. In fact, I was just talking to a person the other day who had been out. I can't remember where now, but he'd been out somewhere looking to airports to see what, you know, what upgrading had been done and so forth. And I'm not sure what's happened in this region of the state, but there was a study about 2 years ago on that. Anyone else who would like to speak? Yes?
I just want to talk a little bit more on health college services. Since last year, our cake season was allocated to work with some of those village programs. We had 10 village-based programs. We have a several other villages that have monthly, or the travel funds, all have it. And there are word curses on, but some boys just start on the chipping. Maybe 3 days of, I'll call it the service of the year. Some are more than 6 days when you talk about kind of educated community or provide counseling service where to start it, to get into it. And, might sound that there's a bunch of money coming on here, but that sort of town was having 56 villages to work with. We're not getting out there as much as we'd like. And we're trying to depend a whole lot on some of those villages for that state aspect. First can accept match the other programs. Now we've got SB168 money available. Some of them want, one place to provide a 50% of preservation. And to me, we still have a long way to go.
Everybody's mentioned 56 villages. Does anybody here know how many of those villages are growing and how many are not growing and how many are getting smaller? If you look at 10 years from now, how many, how many villages are going to be still 56? Are there still going to be? The reason I ask that question is I know that in some parts of the state, at least if you last time I checked this, was some of the villages were actually dying out. I don't know if that's true in the Bethel region, but some villages, the people are migrating to places like Bethel. They're just leaving the villages. The kids don't come back. They leave. When they grow up, they go away. So there's nobody left much except the older generation, and they kind of, so, you know, somewhere down the line, they probably won't even be there. That village won't even be there any longer, you know. I just wondered how many villages, if any, that's true of in the Bethel region. You got 56 villages, how many of them are really stable and going to stay? How many of them are growing?
So I think all of them are growing. And the trend is that at the beginning when we forecast what's gonna happen in 10 years a lot of what's happening though is that a lot of people will migrate to Bethel, they'll find they can't get jobs, can't raise their families here, so they go back to the villages. Mm-hmm. And too, you have to think about all the people that are coming from the last frontier from outside. They're coming up here and they're qualifying and getting the jobs that people would get in central cities like Bethel, Fairbanks, Anchorage. And I think a lot of people are going back to the villages.
Mm-hmm. Nobody, has anybody done any studies of that?
I think maybe the Association of Village Council Presidents might have some statistics on it.
I haven't seen them.
Data, the census, I don't know if it's all been published yet. Right.
That's what I was just going to say. I haven't seen any figures on those yet. So.
But we also see happening is that kids that are going outside for higher education do come back and find that they're really just using them. I think a lot of people depends on what assistance is, what if it's there or not, too. That's going to have an impact.
Do, how many of the villages have some economic base besides assistance?
Other than the school system, they don't have a program.
Official.
Yeah, I really meant in the private sector, you know, not public things like public schools and things, but what kind of economic base, like fishing or lumber or whatever, well, not lumber down here, but anything.
Native corporations are getting more into the timber and oil development. I don't know how much they, you know, income they derive from it now, but I'm sure down the road they will provide it. Any of your villages up there drive the timber now?
Do all the villages have some form of television or access?
I think now they do with satellite, not all of them.
It's one of the things when we were talking about lunch, the cable vision thing, I just thought this came to that work relatively recently. What potential does that play in sort of allowing those educational kinds of things to be taught, relieve some of the duties of the village health aid, I mean, simple hygiene kind of things, changing water. Like, I understand that cable has a lot of potential for local types of programming. Now that it costs money, like almost everything does these days, but is there anything in that kind of area that anybody's
there's going to be a statewide satellite education network. That will, at this point, can receive, but it can't send. It will have the capability eventually, I'm not exactly sure when, to send as well, so that educational programs could be designed and implemented and broadcast from Bethel to the villages.
So this would be the point where the local kind of things could be.
But of course, health programs can be sent out from Anchorage right now, be received in villages. How many villages have it?
5 or 6 villages have satellite television.
That's all they have is satellite television.
As far as I know. And that's what's been added just recently. I represent a program that can be used in villages. Educational TV is quite a big village.
Okay, what type of impact does TV have? I mean, if you were to see people in teaching that part, is it either the burden or the coming of household? I mean, television to me sometimes has some big issue beyond that. I don't know what it works like, but there are other kinds of things that one can learn from, like a new experience. I don't know how to say that question right. Do you see any kind of impact on?
In some of the villages that have refused to have television put in the villages, I've seen a lot better health habits than I have in the villages that have television. But the very fact that they refuse to have television says something about the village. If the village is convinced, you know, that there are other things of recreation other than just sitting in front of the television, and, you know, they have a conviction that, you know, they really want to
teach their children in their own native way. They don't want the outside influence of the television. And one of the villages that I know of is, it's probably the strongest village, one of the strongest villages in the area as far as convention is concerned. A lot of that has to do with just the conviction of the elders of the villages. So, but I have no way of evaluating it. You know, the other, it certainly taught people to be like bilingual, I think, and, you know, I mean, the language barriers. They've learned how to use oil of Olay or something like that. But,
did you see
junk food? Yeah, that kind of thing too. I don't think people have really had the advantage of a lot of educational kind of thing in the way of health care.
I have to say, you know, speaking for my own family in Bethel since the cable was done, Mayor KYUK, which is carrying the heavy preponderance for at least a heavy percentage of the public television type things, news of the week in review, that sort of natural theater, the sort of things you see on PBS. And what you do when you get the cable though is you switch to and on commercial ads and you watch them with the robot. And I figure myself in my head that I'm certain that if you wanted to do the ideal thing, you'd run
broadcast to PBS and keep that kind of exclusive. I would have to be involved with the level of interest kind of programming. But I don't doubt that Sesame Street and some of those pretty school things, kind of educators, have really impacted you before any television or before any radio, and then having watched and had friends with teachers. There's no question that the Sesame Street type of preschool reading preparation sort of things are very educated and help in the academic achievement of kids. Whether it has a big impact on adults or whether it has some super potential for health education, I tend to doubt. There's a lot of things done here. A lot of them are quite good and some of them are clever. Have to do with bullying safety and a number of other areas that are sort of public service announcement type slot shots. And I think they're probably good. I'm going to put it this way. I see an awful lot more life jackets and flotation vests in this area that I ever saw packages where we didn't have. So I'm not sure it's all just really TV advertising. I think it's really the cable itself, though. It's an active way to reduce your self protection. You get in front of it and you can't get away from it.
Well, I don't think that the state would want to be in a position, though, of saying you will get educational TV only. And
I guess not.
I don't think that would be a really good idea. Yes.
I might be overstepping my bounds a little bit, but I don't know if you know me, but I'm Wally Richardson. I run the legislative office here today. But I really feel strong about the teleconference network and as using that as an educational tool for the building. I understand KCC has a telecom network of some sort. I've never seen it or heard of their use for it. But as our network, we have the dialing capabilities and the capability of getting into their own telephone systems. I think that would be a heck of an educational tool.
Could you be a little more? Could you explain that last idea a little bit? I'm not quite sure I understood what you meant.
Using the teleconference network.
And you said in dialing into the villages.
On our teleconference network, we have a dial-in capability of dialing an outside line into the village network
from where? From one of the villages?
From Anchorage or Juneau.
Okay.
I think Fairbanks also has that capability. The opposite. And you just get a teleconference operator. Dial in a certain number, and they'd be included in the
telecom
network itself.
Mm-hmm. You mean from the village?
No.
If I was a monitor at the
time,
would
it be possible? You would dial you, and you would talk.
Would in life be able to hear from the entire hospital?
It would, our conference telephone, yes, the whole room would be able to hear. We'll just have a regular telephone, so it would be just one person.
So it'd be a dial-in capability with maybe a speaker phone at the other end, right?
Right.
In another area of education in this area, I speaking as a person who's just watched parent trial programs developed in several villages. I've been really impressed with the effect that the early childhood education has had on the quality of life in some of the villages. And I understand that some of these programs are not possibly not going to be funded in the future. And I think that they've been extremely valuable and extremely important in some of the villages as far as even they've certainly increased the amount of communication between parents and children, and consequently I think that they've really improved the health, the mental health and the physical health in the villages these early years, and I think that kind of health will carry on into adult years. I think it
beginning, in the first 2 to 3 years, that they have a better chance later on. I'm very, very, you know, strongly in favor of continuation of these early childhood programs in the village. I don't know what plans, you know, the legislature has for these programs. They've been really successful in several of our
What kind of program are you talking about? Are you talking about something like Head Start?
These are programs that are, well, they're funded by rural infant learning programs.
But infant learning programs, that's yeah. Really for children, though, who may have some problem.
Right, that one is,
programs.
But there are parent
infant stimulation things, yeah.
Right. There are parent child programs that are being funded by rural CAP that are for normal children, for all children across the board in the villages. I think there's about 5 or 6 programs out here. And they're free. Like, what do you have? Whatever, for 3 to 5 year olds, you have a Head Start. But these are for children ages 6 months to 3 years. And they've been very successful in some of the villages. The stress has been on teaching parents how to really talk with their children, how to play with the children, how to read to the kids. How to use educational toys and that kind of thing, and that kind of thing is really lacking in a lot of the villages. You really don't see a lot of toys or a lot of books or a lot of any of those things in the villages, and you do see those kinds of things in the villages where they have these early childhood programs. So I feel that the money has been well spent. It's been a very cheap program because all it takes are a couple of visitors that go to the homes of the parents that have these children. And they work with them maybe twice a week, and the responsibility is really put on the parents to continue the program. And there's been a great deal of enthusiasm, and it's been received well in a number of villages out here.
How much of the time a woman comes to the pre-maternal home, and she's here for several weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, right? How much of that, the time that person is here is devoted to any kind of the thing you referred to earlier, I think that you referred to it about proper feeding and so forth for children, and could also tie in what you're just talking about, how you deal with the children once they're born and so forth, besides simple nutrition. Is there an educational program that goes on while a person's in the pre-maternal home? And I'm sure that they got to go see the doctor every day or every 2 days, but that doesn't take all day long, you know, and I imagine they don't just lie around and do nothing. So what is there an educational program?
Yes, there is. The Maternal Child Health, MCH, and I think they have classes
Who conducts that program?
MCH and all.
I know what, I don't know.
Maternal Child Health.
I know, is that federal, state,
or YKHC. Uh-huh.
So YKHC. So they conduct classes then for the pregnant.
Other programs within YKHC also
So that meets part of what you were talking about is part of this need for nutrition education for mothers in the villages.
Right. We've looked at the WIC program.
I think that's one that Congress did not cut. Am I not right on that? I think that's one of the ones that did not reduce the WIC program. I may be wrong on that, but I think so.
From what I've heard, though, they failed to fund new programs in the state of Alaska, which continue not the programs they already have.
And anyone else on any?
I do have a proposal.
You know, the only suggestion I could offer would be to pursue it. You have local area representatives that you certainly first should contact with, and I would encourage you to present it to Helen Byrne in addition, because possibly if there's any adversary position that's going to be developed by her department to the proposal, you might as well get those ironed out before the hearing process if you possibly can. And then, of course, they will come as an automatic thing after your local representatives submit them to these like committees in the Senate and the House, where they'll be reviewed further. And I just get it in.
I have it off the chair.
Sometimes the best unprepared suggestions are the most solution-oriented. You know, you're not confused with all the reasons why you can't do it. Half of the bureaucratic structure responds to a set of rules that somebody wrote. Only two things that are inviolate. And that, if you're religious, that's the Ten Commandments. And if you believe in our form of government, that's the Constitution. But there are even provisions to change those. So what becomes so sacred about a set of regulations or a statute on the books? Sounds reasonable, then. But, you know, why don't we do it? Possibly because nobody's pushed for it, really.
You say upgrade the capabilities in what?
In other areas, health things that talk to procedure simple cuts, things like that. And patients don't have to spend $40, $60, $80, $100, $100 just to come in for a simple procedure. They were doing that in some areas, let's say 10 years ago. In some areas, the health aides all have IV equipment, and they used it. And I think statistics will prove that many a health aide has saved a person's life just because they were able to put up a simple IV in the village site and then ship the patient back. And doctors are claiming that if it wasn't for that, the patient wouldn't have made it. And in this area, the health aides don't have that capability. Very few do. Whereas in other areas, every health aid does.
But you know, if you would have...
I thought that in the early 70s, they were pushing for standardizing the health aid capabilities in the state of Alaska.
There was, but again, we come back to the same thing. We voice concerns and objections or suggestions, and then we each go about our business again, and always hoping that the next guy will take care of the problem. But you know, I have to agree with you totally. The military has an excellent system of corpsmen. What do they call them in the Army? Medics. And those guys, extensions, when village health aides were first proposed, that's what I thought they were going to do. Have the capability of doing exactly what, you know, a service corpsman did. Did all kinds of things. But of course, those individuals were trained. Yet the same situation in paraprofessional. You know, you have the attorney who's admitted to the bar doing the glamour work. He's on the floor, but two-thirds of everything he's presenting, some paralegal professional did.
You know, if there was a more advanced training, you wouldn't be equipped.
Mm-hmm. Are the health aides covered by the Good Samaritan Act? What? Well,
at least that's what they tell us. Now, we never have had a case to really prove that they are covered, because that's the only
thing. Well, is the insurance carried on them, but I don't know that, or are they covered?
I'm having supervision in our condition, which makes under the medical supervision in this position. And our condition is dependent on the federal courts, which essentially is a non-insurance, the government under us to defend their responsibilities. It's not an immunity, nor is it even if it's an American kind of thing. So that, you know, I don't know what area of the way you're talking about where they need to do more. I think in the past few, the insurance and surgery is done, and somehow they do have more training than the majority of them do here. I question whether their functions are essential that different. I think what you tend to find is you also get better at case finding when you're helping training for the doctor. So the need for, at least they recognize the need for more acute care or more intensive care is recognized more frequently, and more people tend to come into their hospital.
Joe, could I ask an obvious question, and certainly no one wished to compromise you, but it's one that should be asked, though. Is there an attitudinal restriction, though, by the professional doctor as to what he wants the aide to perform? Is he conscious of possible involvement in the liability activity and therefore limits?
I don't believe that in my personal experience, I don't see much of a desire to restrict the fact that you can do what you do find out are poorly trained health things who do not perform the spirit of good that means by attempting to do things that they're not able to do. And once a physician has had an experience of that nature, he's going to be more careful with that particular health thing. Now, one of our things that is a constant need require a lot of attention, professional and administrative, is making this system work. It's been in place so long, everybody tends to think that the health aides are really good folks who never make mistakes, and we have great relationships with doctors. The reality is that health aides do turn over. Some of them are not terribly confident. The village gets unhappy with them. Our doctors, the health aid coordinators, and the instructors all have to be in that picture trying to keep viable this vital primary care thing. You're fortunate if you have the kind of health aides check her viability as a deliverer and as an image for your clinic. And those things are not directly the responsibility of any of us, at the same time, are vital to whether we're functioning well or not. And so, if the outpatient system is not a very simple, no problem thing, but it's not that it could stand lots of upgrading in terms of salaries, in terms of training, in terms of equipment. We're running out of money at area level for the maintenance of the Village-built clinic leases. Are probably going to be one of the next problem areas in terms of finance. They're deteriorating. Our rent that we're paying the villages for this space is not expanding with their costs. There is supposedly a factor in there for capitalization of new equipment, which isn't happening, and that's what they put in there, so I'm sure the state will be hearing and think of this already. So the needs to refurnish those clinics to get new exam tables to get whatever. And I don't have the supply budget to frankly do it adequately before we have. So, you know, there's almost no area you can look at that we say, this is static, this is great, this is the way to ideally deliver healthcare. You know, it sounds as if you're doing nothing but begging and crying, but the basic healthcare system is just recently in effect in this region. And we're feeling a very powerful fear that it's something like that. So I feel bad too. And that's the third one we're trying to miss. But not a very good fear.
What's the turnover rate among the village health aides?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty probably right around 12%. Maybe a little higher than that right now.
Mm-hmm. That's not too bad, really, considering some or other.
It's kind of stabilized. We do have a whole lot as to who is hired the position.
Does every village, every one of the 56 villages, have a village health aide and a clinic?
We have four villages with
outcomes
that work within the VIA school system, which means during summertime.
And BIA wouldn't arrange to have those open in the summer?
Well, they
don't,
all the teachers leave during the summer months and they take a janitor.
I know.
In most of the cases, the janitor is more than
they're inadequate as clinic facilities anyway.
No, I just was asking a question. It seems like the kind of thing is it's not a matter of money, it's a matter of just getting somebody to do something, right, in that particular case. How many of those 56 clinics are deteriorating, like you said, all of them? Or 52, rather, I should say.
Frankly, I get a report. Every 3 years, we do a comprehensive environmental health survey on each one. And I frankly have had just a few of those cross my desk, and each and every one is just that. Thank you.
then available for some construction to do. And I don't know how to take advantage of it here, but around the state, there's quite a few fairly recent buildings, i.e. the last 5 to 8 years, that were constructed in our lease by our lease system. But there's always a village or two that has just couldn't get it together or didn't want to build a van or have a still log cabin and a pretty old facility.
We have a total of 64 primary health aides, and that's based on village population. Some have three health aides. And then most of them just one. That's based on population, and that is really up to one should, because like Marshall or most of the villages on the Yukon, they should at least have two full-time primaries for most of them, not just one. So we do have 64 primaries.
I was asking about the clinics and how old they were, because I was wondering if somebody had been in one of those cases where people built stuff and it's falling apart after 3 or 4 years. It just seems to happen pretty frequently. Well, what I think was said, that a lot of those cases, they simply lease some existing building, right? And that's,
a lot of them were built as sort of prefabricated houses, and whenever you're in the house, you get caught out there in a storm or something, you feel like the building's just going to go, you know? That's kind of a scary feeling. Even though they might not be any more than like 10 years old, feel older.
I don't think there are any standards set for number of exam rooms, size of the room. The heating plan is pretty much a decision of the local community. You know, there was no attempt at saying this is the minimum standard that we would accept. It was kind of what we could lease and what we would have available. Which may have been registered for the state.
Anyone else have anything else to offer?
Do you have any information or on House Bill 41? Or you had mentioned that that would be discussed today. Maybe we discussed before I came in.
No one has mentioned it so far. So you can be the first one. Let me just tell you the status before you begin, if you don't mind. That bill has passed the House. It came to the Senate Health Committee. It has not been even heard in the Senate Health Committee. That's status of it, right, as of now, right? Just so you know. Okay. So go ahead.
So it's passed the House, though. Do you think it has a good chance of passing?
Let me say, I think some bill in that same general direction will pass, but whether there's another bill in the committee as well put in by Senator Petula, which doesn't go as far as this. And frankly, we held off action on the bill until next year. One of the main reasons was to have the input from the Patel study that I mentioned is going on, right? Because that obviously deals pretty closely with this. How many people are there with no health care, no plan of any kind, no insurance? What do they need, and you know, et cetera. So that's why there's been no action on it. So I don't, but what the chances are that this bill in its present form will go through, I'd say very slight. But something in it that goes in the same direction will, I think.
Will there be, at the present time, it sounds like people that are served by Indian Health Service are not included in this bill. So if the federal government pulls out of Indian Health Service care, that's going to increase the number of people that will be able to receive benefit of House Bill 41. Or you're just not expecting the federal government to pull out?
If the federal government pulled out completely, you mean, right?
Yes.
Send that money to Arizona.
Right. Okay. Is there a provision to include Native American people in this? Is that just
I don't really know at this point on that. That's a question I haven't addressed. I don't know. I'd have to get one of the attorneys on it to see if we make sure we're doing something legal there. But
I'm on the advisory committee for health and development, and next week will be our second meeting on the bill. But I think right now what we're looking at, just I just cut back from the house and cut everybody in the house to the regional health directors that are looking more at the rural areas, of course. Mm-hmm. We also need to look at the tie the two together. I'd like to give you a copy of my letter that I submitted to George Holman and Sackett. In regards to how supportive I was in the units that we have, I think they could read it. Or read it.
It's up to you if you'd like to read it.
It just really mentions just about everything we've been discussing today.
One thing that's going to have to be remembered, of course, is that under the state constitution, the state will not be able to make separate provisions for Alaska Natives from everybody else. These benefits are going to be available, they're going to be available across the board. Now, if under House Bill 41 or something like it, right, the state was, for example, to say we're going to fly people in the villages, as an example, they could not restrict that to Alaska Native. They could fly anybody in that village who got sick. It's just an obvious example. If a state is going to pick up the cost of insurance policy, it can't do it to one group only. Now, the only reason that the Indian Health Service exclusion is in here is that's being looked at just as if it was a Blue Cross policy. Right? Somebody has some kind of a coverage already. It could be Blue Cross, it could be IHS, it could be the military, right? But if somebody's got coverage already, and what the bill was looking at was people who don't really have any coverage. And it's not because they're natives or not, it's simply because they had a coverage already existing, in effect. Now, if we go into this thing, of course, and if we do anything to start with this, then it goes across the board to everybody. But it would be, and just what you said originally, if IHS pulled out completely, there wouldn't be any more coverage, right? Then obviously they'd be entitled to the same as anybody else would be that didn't have any. But as long as IHS is still furnishing some things, there is some coverage there. And, you know, people who are covered that way do not get the other kind.
I think what you need to do is also take into consideration the exclusions that IHS has.
I've tried to get a list of those, Ms. Pavel, over a year now. I have been trying to find out from IHS which things they will not cover. And you know, I have never gotten a definitive answer. I asked for it in June last March or so. Let me finish. And I didn't get it. And so finally, we had a workshop one day, and it was a guy there representing IHS, and I said, I'm a little disappointed, never got an answer. He says, I'll get you one, right? So 3 weeks or a month later, I get a letter. And it says, well, we really can't tell you, but historically we have not covered these things. And didn't say what we're going to do next year, right? And I have never yet gotten a definitive list from IHS that says, as we were told once, for example, we will not furnish mental health care, mental health treatment. I did get that in writing one time, that was their policy. But that's the only thing I ever got positively guaranteed that they would not furnish. If you've got a final list, I'd like to have a copy of it. But they're not on this committee, see, it's a really serious matter because we have not been able to get them to come down and say, these things we will not punish, period. And then we know that, we know something then, but we haven't been able to get that.
Senator, I told you I would defend my
system. Well, I'm not blaming you because I didn't ask you for it, I asked somebody else for it.
I'm just saying, one of the problems is that our mission is so broad. Very difficult to say we're going to exclude that. We will provide the highest possible level of care to the Alaska Natives or American Indians. And, you know, there's no end to that. If that means bypass surgery 4 times a week, you know, theoretically, we can do it.
Well, I got a bad reaction this morning when I mentioned the word triage. But that's what everybody really does in some ways or other. You can do it in non-medical areas, right? You set priorities, and that's exactly what you're doing. And I don't know why IHS can't set priorities and say we've got limited funds, and these are where our money is going. And then, you know, maybe I won't agree with their priorities, as maybe you might not. But the point is, I don't know why they can't do that and say the money is not going to stretch to do, let's say, a cosmetic facelift, or whatever it happens to be, right? And we know this in advance, and so it's not going to be funded, period. You know? I don't know why they can't do that.
I find it frustrating,
too. But
we have talked about a basic benefits package, which is another way of approaching the same issue. Still haven't gotten that.
Well, it would certainly be helpful to know that. I think I agree with Pavel completely. That's something we need. Yes?
Sure. I know that you heard from the hospital administration and the staff this morning regarding the provision of health care to non-beneficiaries and beneficiaries. I just want you to be aware that as a native of this community, I am aware of conflict and, I don't know, maybe malcontention on this issue. I'll tell you, I work with some white people, and the one gal is pregnant. She's going to have a baby, and she came here, and she specifically came back to Bethel because she thought it was such a good system here, and she could have her baby, and everything, you know, she could just do real well. But now she finds that she may not be getting services, or she may be misunderstanding. There's a lot of confusion. In our local paper, in the Anchorage paper I just read before I came here, there's misrepresentation on the issue, and I also would like to say that I think there are a lot of natives in this community that would, if there was a private doctor that was allowed to practice at the hospital here, a lot of the natives, just for the choice and because they could do it, would choose private, to have a private condition. My husband and I, he works for the federal government and I'm working for the state right now. We've had insurance, you know, for how many numbers of years now, but we've never been able to use it. Every now and then we get to Anchorage and we go buy a pair of glasses. And we're able to use our insurance that way. But I just want you to know that there are a lot of natives here that would be able to support a position.
Either the city of Bethel or the Yukon Custom Health Corporation ever tried to get a doctor out here?
Yes, they did.
What happened to
There was nobody interested because those people that they approached, they wouldn't come out here because they were sure that all of the people that were here, the non-natives, were going to the hospital and getting any medical services that they needed for, well, almost nothing is what it's amounted to. For all these years, you know, they'd go up there, and I think it was $9, and then jumped up to $15 a visit for almost...
It's $9, $12, or $15.
$9, $12, or $15. Well, that's, you know, that's next to nothing, really. I think
$9, $12, or $15.
But, you know, now, I think now, there's a good chance that somebody would be interested in coming out if they could be assured of using the facility out there.
Well, I understand there's some problems.
The city has set aside a small amount of money for feasibility.
$2,500.
Yeah, but I think that's a first step. We're very hopeful and we'll try to support the community and everybody we can to make this a reality. I think the private system is absolutely necessary.
Well, now, a private doctor would not have staff privileges, is that right?
Not at this point, literally, but we're hoping we can work that out. Or he could volunteer his time. Transfer his patients to us while they're inpatients to see if we can get his outpatients. There are a few ways to work with them, which I'm trying.
I read about a rural county back in Pennsylvania, I think it was once. There's a rural county back there, farming area. They didn't have a doctor and they were having trouble getting one. And what they did was to guarantee a doctor $50,000 a year for his first year. You know, even if he didn't make a nickel off patients, they would guarantee him $50,000. Then they dropped it down over several years to where he was strictly on his own. And they got a doctor that way. And of course, that was back east where prices are lower, salaries are lower, and also this was several years ago. So you might have to guarantee somebody $100,000 to come to Bethel. I don't know. It wouldn't be surprising. I doubt that many doctors in Alaska don't make $100,000 a year. But, you know, that would be a way to go. Somebody, either the corporation or the city might think about, you know, is getting them in. And then, of course, they make up to say the difference between whatever he made off his patients his first year and $100,000 might cost him $20,000 or $30,000. I don't know. But it might be possible to get a doctor if he's offered some deal, something, no, not necessarily that particular deal, but something along that would make it. And of course, he would need to have hospital privileges, I'm sure. Because doctors probably won't practice very much today unless they can get hospital privileges, right?
Everything you could ask, change in what those rules and regulations are made and what's so sacred about them. It seems to me that the simplest way would, I mean, we have a lot of doctors here already. The simplest way would be to change some of these rules and regulations that tie up that Indian hospital just for one specific thing. I mean, how much did that thing cost? Who paid for it? Was it taxpayer?
Yes.
That's right. And why can't some of those ridiculous rules be changed so that a private doctor can use those facilities, or the rest of the population can use it and be charged at a reasonable cost, which could help support that hospital? It seems to me that would be the first way to go, or the main way to approach the problem.
Equality is like art. It's in the eye of the beholder. But didn't the city of Juneau, Dennis, just do that with the, what do you call the guys who deliver babies? Yeah, that Salmon Creek deal out there. Didn't they just do that? They guaranteed a guy to come in, pediatrician.
Yeah, no, well, that was PHS, actually, that they brought in, and they folded their thing on their opportunity. But they didn't go quite to the suggestion of charging. They brought them in, provided them a clinic, and they were a health service force position. And what happened, one of them almost wasn't happy, so they went back down for a few days. But the other one didn't feel comfortable about moving into practice medicine on the service basis. He sort of wandered off.
Well, I heard the city got him to stay, and they guaranteed to bring the other one in or something. I don't know, anyway, but it paralleled, you know, basically your type of suggestion there.
Oh. I'm suggesting this, well, we have a pediatrician here. If a white child needed the hospital care, why couldn't the rules be changed if it has to be done in Washington so that the pediatrician can charge what the going rate is for a visit, and that went to his hospital's bottom?
Well, I think we'd agree, except you said the key words have to be changed in Washington.
Well,
and that's where, you know, that's where the legislature doesn't have much to do about it. You know? We can recommend.
I don't know where it has to be.
Well, I believe those are federal laws that they operate under, you see, and federal regulations.
It's very hard to understand here, but if you think of it like a VA hospital, it makes a little more sense, where they have been mandated by law to serve specific kinds of veterans, and people who are not veterans are simply excluded. They never are in a situation like we are, where we are the only game in town. So Indian Health Services have this kind of a problem, and has gotten around it by trying to accommodate the non-native population out of funding intended for the native population. And that's our basic problem. At one end, we'd love to see income as well as service.
Right.
Is there a reasonable way to go? Here, you know, it's stupid to go to the hospital for 2,000 people.
Yeah, and we're not isolated here. You've got the same parallel circumstance in Arizona, Wyoming, Montana, you know, half a dozen of the western states. And once somebody does that on the congressional level, I think you'd find support to change the law.
I think we are excited. I think we are unique because
Indian
Health Services there's not enough service as we go to Anchorage for. And I had hurt my back. And
and I was anticipating that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't stand for more than a minute, I couldn't sit for more than a minute. I escorted these two patients into Lafayette Medical Center, and they put me up because I escorted. And the girl from the vice said, well, why don't you try to see an orthopedic doctor while you're here? And I said, because I don't think I'll get to see one. So she said, well, why get your appointment when you see him? I said, certainly. Because of weather, I didn't do that in prospect to a hero's place for 4 days, even though I flew over once. And my girlfriend had to talk to college every ortho party in Anchorage and couldn't get me an appointment for 2.5 months. Followed back, very disgusted, and I said, well, Linda, I told you in the first place not to bother. And this is the true story it happened to me. The AAMC doctor, the wife of one of the ill patients, told the doctor that I was in bad shape, and he did give me, I think it was 292, and he said, sorry, you couldn't do any more than me because I wasn't out of the picture. I was in such pain that I had hardly fallen out of bed. And that I can foresee happening here, too.
And you arrived on the plane, you had to know the names. We are developing a list at the hospital and trying to contact practitioners in Anchorage by phone, but most practitioners are pretty full of Anchorage. There's not a great deal of desire to take in new patients, particularly if they're looking for specialists. It's really very difficult. Even with the wherewithal of the third-party insurance in your pocket, it's not easy. And in practice, really not practical. Have your main source of care 500 miles away.
Well, are there any reasons other than the existing federal law and regulations why this thing shouldn't be loosened up like this?
I don't think so. We have the capacity, we have the space, we almost have enough personnel. What we need is facilitating pieces of ability to do it.
Is there anyone else who has anything to add?
Sir, I just have one more comment.
No,
I'll go.
No, thank you.
I work for the Parent Child Program. It's an early childhood development program. Mm-hmm. I'm a coordinator and I go to 2 villages here in this region. I just came back to see what yesterday. And what we've just found out recently is that the state plans to decrease our budget and the federal government wants to phase the program out completely. I think that the program really does well in the villages. We've got support from the village council, the IRA council, and the city council, and the parents groups and the educators in the village that this program is a really worthwhile program. In this program, the component areas that are covered, we have educational toys, books, and we have homemade activities that are relevant to the people that we serve. And with these toys, books, and activities, we try to cover the component areas of health, education, referrals for special needs, special services, parent involvement. We try to give more material for interaction between the parents and the children. We have ongoing training programs for the home visitors that bring the information back to the villages, to the village that they work in. And it's just been a really worthwhile program. This may be the last year that we have funding. After October 18th of this year, we may not have an operating budget. So I just like to say that I would really urge support for the program.
Now these are the... This is not the infant stimulation program. This
no,
is the
infant stimulation works for children that require special needs or handicapped children.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure we're disabled. I wanted to make sure we were talking about the different other one, the normal or well children, or you want to call it. Okay.
And they're served. It's a low income program, but all of the villages. All of the villages that we serve all for the reason of they say poverty of access. They do not have access to adequate health care or social services and to the educational programs that are offered in other areas.
Thank you. Okay, is anyone else? Last call coming up. Sorry, go ahead. Are you asking if it will be available next year?
When will they be available?
I think so, probably. How much, I don't know.
Me too, Fred.
But I think it'll be, I think they'll be for capital funding next year. But I don't know how much. And that's just my guess, right? Okay, well, if there's any, no one else that wishes to say anything, then we'll be closing up. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have a question I'd like to ask.
Sure.
Who would it, or what would it take to try to get that federal law changed?
Well, that's one thing that could come out of the work of this committee, but the best that we could do would be to pass a resolution by the legislature asking Congress to change it. If it's, you know, if it's federal law or regulation, we couldn't do anything about it ourselves because we don't have that authority. But we could do that, send a resolution to Congress and the President asking them to change this. I think that would make a distinction between Alaska and other parts of the country, because most other parts of the country you have a reservation system.
And where IHS is operating, you know, is mainly on reservations. We don't really have that. And so I think there is a reason or justification for doing something differently up here. I don't know if that would, you know, whether they'd make an exception in our case or whether they would just simply change the regulations or the law, I don't know. But that's about all we could really do about it. We could do that once we go back in January. But the attempt should be made.
Yeah.
And you can further do assist by contacting the congressional delegation, too. Maybe with a resolution from your city council. A resolution from YKHC.
Send it to all of them. Stevens, Mark Murkowski, and Young. Won't hurt. Just an extra 20 cents a piece. Okay, nothing else? Adjourn.
The thing that we run into is that when a public health nurse leaves, they leave that particular area vacant for at least 6 months in order to save money. So that everything that the public health nurse has tried to work, you know, work up, even though she's been in a community for 6 or 7 years, by the time the next nurse gets there, it takes her a year to get to know the people. And so consequently, a lot of the programs that were started when that public health nurse was there, because there's no overlapping of personnel, are down the drain in just that year that the villages are left uncovered. So that's another big problem. I think, too, public health nurses may visit a village maybe 3 or 4 times a year, but they have constant radio contact with the villages, so that this person is constantly in contact with the health aides and does really set up a very good rapport with the health aides. And if there were more public health nurses in each of the area, you know, if we did have more public health nurses, I think that she would be able to go to the villages more frequently, keep better contact, and possibly do a lot more in the area of education and prevention, because she would be a logical person to do this type of service if she had enough time and time in the village.
Well, how about the things that Mr. Joe was talking about here, about the, I guess he pointed out the fact that there was a pipe going here. Supposedly all the good news is that tobacco's bad for your health. And he mentioned his own problem of reducing weight. And how many of these educational problems are going to be addressed to people who can't, education, how much instruction is going to be addressed to people who can and will change their lifestyles, because it's just something they didn't know before, right? And then how much of it's just going to be telling people, don't do that because it's bad for you, and the person says, I'm going to do it anyway. No, if you were talking about dealing with 2,000 people, Ms. Pelker was. So, you know, those 2,000, how many are really just needing
information, needing education, and so they can live more healthily, right? And then how many are just people who have bad habits they aren't going to change anyway? Is that half and half? Or, in other words, how often is a problem one of not knowing, and how much is it a problem of knowing but saying, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway?
You know, I think I wouldn't be able to venture a guess. Because, to tell you the truth, since I've been here these 4.5 years, I have been busy doing other things, you know, a lot of different things because of my experience. Because of the problem, I would like to be able to have the time to spend sort of planning health programs that would address the people who do want to change their lifestyle, who don't have the information at the present time.
It's work and we're more concerned.
understand what's being said to them. Make sure that every person in the room understands what they're talking about. The kids, you know, the smaller ones, like she was saying, I've got to teach a little bit over a long period of time. I can't teach a little bit of one child. But the older adults that have experience, like some of our native people, we have still traditional counselors that are experienced with our lifestyle. They're effective people when it comes to talking to people in their own community or other communities. And to me, it's important that for them to know too that the Eastern Water, that the state is trying to use their standards, like we need trained counselors at the village level. We're not saying that the state standards are no good. It's just that we need help in getting up to that level, you know, up there in the village. So it takes time. Like, we're not going to educate everybody in rural areas in just 1 year. We need an ongoing program, something steady, like through the school system, other organizations.
The K through 12 school program, alcohol program, Fred was talking about is here's looking at you. And it was discussed at the last governor's advisory board meeting on alcohol and drug use. There seemed to be a fair degree of support at that meeting from people who were attending and from members of the board that it would be a good idea for the state to mandate that program in all the schools in the state and to provide appropriate funding for that.
I can only say that the school district in my own area did not adopt that program. They decided they wanted their own. And one reason they wanted their own was that they could integrate, they wanted a program they could integrate into various other subjects, and instead of taking a separate one. I don't know if they're right or wrong, but I know they didn't want to take that one. They would resist it very strongly being told they had to. And I know some other school boards have had the same kind of reaction. They don't want the state telling them to do anything. Ketchikan, I remember, was one of those.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure which other ones. But.
No, having been instrumental in that entire package and creating the first available monies for Here's Looking At You to be presented, Senator Parr is correct. We will stop when it comes to the point of mandating. What we do is paramount to mandating. Because the Here's Looking At You programs, the state last year, I believe, put $675,000 worth of state monies into it if the school district elected to use it. But that local autonomy attitude just prevails in the legislature. And I agree, because here's a good example. The city of Fairbanks, in their wisdom of North Star Borough, decided that that particular program really wouldn't serve their needs, and I can't fault that. The packet of materials may not relate to. Here's Looking At Your programs that I've seen so far are great for the urban areas. I don't think the relationship or the retention factor of being viewed in the villages is going to be other than something that occupied some time.
Alaska, because the copy I seen from K through 8 was revised for Alaska.
Yes.
Alaska, Alaska.
But the last presentation I saw was about 3 months ago. The new revised one that's been revised for at least the Anchorage Independent School District. And some of the scenes in there just are not applicable out here. Mom and Dad are going to the ball, and it just isn't there. But what you're saying, short of mandating, we can suggest, and we do that in other areas too. Special ed, monies are available, you make application for them. Because personally, I still feel that a great part of the problems that we're voicing here today have come about solely because of mandating, of trying to regiment a system that you're trying to apply area-wide based on the experience of a specific locale. Otitis Media, for example, is not a problem in urban Alaska. It sure is out here.
Which, I guess,
naturally
brings up the HSA as a help. And I guess, I would like to say that I'm convinced that we need regional planning. It can't be a statewide plan for health. I'm not talking about the insurance plan.
No.
It's under discussion. You know, sort of, here's where we put our resources around the state. And I, you know, sort of lament the demise of the potential of the HSA. I'm not sure they always lived up to their potential. Hopefully, for the state, some continuation of regional planning that includes a place like Bethel having input in response, and then having a response to the planning process to its particular needs, as opposed to, you know, having a statewide initiative or statewide mandate program. And then the Georgia found that Georgia's our representative, one of our representatives from his region on the South Central HSA. Right? Just, you know, while I'm a Fed, and we're not as flexible as perhaps I'd like to be in responding to local planning efforts, we are quite supportive of the notion of taking a look at the needs of the Delta and a larger region, perhaps, and contributing our input into that. And I say, I personally feel that the loss of HSA would be a serious loss, although their presence has not, you know, made revolution. It's improved a lot of things in a very gradual and positive way. I just wanted to bring up the HSA before we turned it. They seem to me to be our hope for using a worldwide.
This region should comfortable being with a free trade HSA.
I'm a little new here to say.
Well, I think your representation is that HSA people come on here and present workshops on various things. They come on as technical advisors to many of the rural programs that we're trying to develop.
I would agree it's a good resource, though an HSA can only be as effective as the quality of the data it's able to gather. And I think that all the way down the line, data gathering is a problem. And I think it's not because the technology doesn't exist, it's really a matter of funding. The HSA had more money and to get out here more to supervise the collection of data, I think they'd be even more effective.
Most of your tribal specific health plan information and data was put into those